You're listening to the COVID-19 Update, a podcast from the CSIS Global Health Policy Center focused on the science and policy implications of the outbreak. I'm Andrew Schwartz of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and I'm joined by my colleague, Steve Morrison, to discuss the latest on COVID-19.
We're delighted today to be joined by Andrew Witte, co-lead for the ACT Accelerator and WHO envoy for COVID-19. And I'll say a few words about his background and the interactions we've had here at CSIS. But welcome, Andrew, and thank you for making time with us today.
Steve, thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'm also joined by my colleague, Catherine Bliss, who will be with us on this podcast. Andrew, we met back in March 2016 when you spoke at CSIS and delivered a very eloquent speech announcing your retirement plans a year later from GSK, that period when you were the president and CEO of GSK. But you spoke of a different era of ethics in business, of innovation balancing as concern with equity and access, of greater transparency and accountability standards. And much of that thinking, I believe, carries forward today when we start talking about something like the ACT Accelerator and equity and access for low and middle income countries that are looking for vaccine therapies, diagnostics, and other key inputs in this period. The 9 years that you were there at GSK, you set pricing standards, you created the patent pool, you helped mobilize the world around NTDs, and really brought another ethic and set of concerns around how industry can partner with others in moving that sort of agenda today. You started in your role as co-lead on the ACT Accelerator on April 20th, joined with Ngozi Okonjo Iweala, and you will be carrying forward, as I understand from what you said, in that role up until December 1st, not too long from now. So why don't we start? Give us a quick recap of these past months, your role, and what you've observed in this period, which has been a very rapid stand-up of this new entity, the ACT Accelerator. Give us sort of a quick recap of what has happened and what has emerged in the formation of this new coalition, this new partnership.
Of course. Thanks so much, Steve. So let me start, first of all, ACT is Access to COVID Tools Accelerator. And so the goal of all of this is to help develop, scale up, and then make available at very high volumes the kinds of medicines, vaccines, technologies which could make a real difference to bringing this pandemic under control and ultimately bringing it to an end. And importantly, thinking about that challenge on a global basis, regardless of income, regardless of country status, recognizing this pandemic is truly a global situation. So back in March, April, as you, I'm sure, will be super well aware, huge mobilization of many different organizations and countries to start to think about how to respond here. Tremendous energy being deployed in the private and the public sector around research agendas. And the ACT-A coalition was really brought together a group of key actors, so the World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, the European Commission, number of other individual countries, the Wellcome Charitable Foundation, and others, all came together to say, look, you know, rather than all racing along in parallel, can we bring ourselves together much more as a flotilla, if you will, of significant research health agencies, delivery agencies, and of course, funders in the form of countries and the like. And so the effort or the intention through the ACT Accelerator wasn't to create anything new, no new institution, no new big organization, but to really try and wire together all of those pre-existing skills and teams of people in as light a way as possible so that we could represent a broad perspective on how best to tackle this pandemic, that we could think through some of the key policy dimensions that are critical in ensuring equitable access globally. So, for example, not-for-profit pricing, for example, attitude towards indemnity and liability protection on new technologies, the things which have got in the way historically. And then how might we help channel funding and skills to the places which could deliver the quickest positive progress first. The ACT Accelerator is essentially organized very simply: vaccine pillar, diagnostic pillar, therapeutics pillar, and then what we call a health system connector, which focuses on PPE and oxygen provision, recognizing that management of this pandemic starts with diagnostics and prevention strategies, but all too often ends up with clinical interventions in a hospital setting. So that hopefully gives you a quick oversight of the initiation of the program.
Thank you. Now, just as I recall from the spring, I mean, there was an awareness in this period that there was a dominance of nationalism, hyper-nationalism in many of the responses. This is a pandemic that was striking most countries of the world with a ferocity, and many countries, quite understandably, first response to sort of try to arrest the emergency in their midst and take care of their sovereign interests and responsibilities. But as over time, as the rush towards development and accelerating vaccines and diagnostics and therapies took hold, there was a fear of the most powerful and most wealthy were going to really dominate. There was a pre-purchase of 4 billion doses. There was a fear that the world was going to become a very bifurcated and unequal place, and that low and middle income countries might soon find themselves left behind, delayed in a period of uncertainty, lack of affordable access. Tell me, do you feel that that fear, that threat is strong enough? Is that a powerful enough motivator to get powerful and wealthy countries to come to the table for the type of asks that are coming out of the ACT Accelerator? Because it's putting numbers against the requirements. Maybe you can talk about the COVAX facility. And, you know, there are some pledges of funds, but it's still falling pretty far short of what's really required. And it's coming at a period when countries are really, really stretched in meeting their own urgent requirements that are not just the vaccine procurement, but meeting the health requirements, dealing with all of the economic dislocations and the stimulus requirements and everything. It's an extraordinarily demanding period to be coming and making this kind of ask. And so I wanted to ask you, because you were the lead element in putting the whole marketing side of this together in trying to make the case to the world's most wealthy and powerful that they need to think beyond the immediate nationalist requirements.
No, listen, that's a huge question. Let me try and give you as concise a perspective as I can. So yes, you're absolutely right. There was a concern, I think, in many places that we could end up with a little bit of a kind of breakdown in the multilateral solidarity approach to this pandemic if things went badly. I don't believe that has happened, actually. I think we've seen sustained engagement from very large numbers of countries in thoughtful ways in which they can help ensure that technologies, first of all, are developed. That's obviously the absolutely key critical phase. You know, if we go back to January 1, there were no treatments, no vaccines, no diagnostics for this virus. And so you have to start where you begin, which is you've got to start inventing things. So a huge amount of energy behind that. Even from the very earliest days, a number of global leaders identified the need to ensure that we take into account the low middle income countries and not simply the rich countries. That has then translated as the scoping of what's really required as a global response has been done by the ACT-A teams. We can tell you, you know, to do a good job, I think it's probably $30 to $40 billion required on a global basis over the next, let's say, two and a half years to deliver vaccines to significant, not everybody, but to significant and the most needed recipients around the world, to have the right amount of drug and diagnostics available, and to ensure that PPE and oxygen are available where they're needed. Not for every situation, but enough to bring stability back to the global environment in the face of this pandemic. Now, what we've seen since April is actually, you know, it's glass half full, glass half empty, Steve. Have we raised $30 to $40 billion? No. Have we received over $5 billion from a standing start April 20th? Yes. Has anybody ever done that before in global public health agendas? No. Normally, those sorts of fundraising agendas take years of planning and preparation, and then, only then, do they raise those sorts of sums of money. And just in the last 6 weeks, we've seen the World Bank step forward and inject into very much the same space about $12 billion of further resources, which can be used by countries to purchase diagnostics, vaccines and drugs. So when you step back from that, really almost before any of the technologies had been finished, we already had a very substantial amount of the firepower required to get going. What's going to be critical, and to your very good question, is over the next 12 months, we need the balance. You know, we need the balance as we start to go through the scale up of procurement of these technologies. But for sure, ACT-A has enough to do what it's doing today. It has enough to write the contracts with the vaccine companies to secure vaccines for 2 billion people in the low middle income countries. Absolutely unparalleled achievement. 186 countries have signed up to COVAX, which is an extraordinary, I think it is perhaps the single biggest multilateral collaboration in history in terms of just the numbers of countries who have joined. And those are the low middle income countries, some of the poorest countries in the world, the middle income countries, and some of the richest countries in the world have signed up to that initiative. And so I think we are midstream, Steve. Do we need more? Yes. Super encouraged by, even in the last couple of days, the G20's communique, which really laid out a high level political commitment and prioritization of the ACT-A coalition as our best bet to address this pandemic. But we, of course, now need to see that translated into real financial commitments above and beyond those which I've already mentioned. I am quietly confident it will happen. I think now the technologies are becoming available. It's become clearer what people are buying and paying for, if I can put it that way. And I think we can be optimistic that over the next couple of years, we ought to be able to respond to the first truly global pandemic in 100 years with what should be the world's most impressive global response.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the G20. I mean, what happened this weekend was quite encouraging, the pretty unequivocal endorsement. There were no numbers in that. There's a certain nervousness, I think, in the system. We've seen it. The letter that went from Prime Minister Solberg and President Ramaphosa, along with Tedros and the head of the EC, Ursula von der Leyen, urgent need for 4.5 billion additional resources. UN Secretary General Guterres, his communication right before saying, you know, 4.2 billion urgent. I think the Paris Forum had raised another 300 or 400 million in between those letters, but continuing to press that we're going to need eventually to get to 28 billion and we're going to need to really move this forward. I want to ask Catherine Bliss to join in here.
Well, thank you. You know, I wanted to focus on, you know, the U.S. role, I mean, with respect to COVAX in particular. So back in August, the United States announced that it would not be joining the COVAX facility, has kind of made a plan to work through Operation Warp Speed and focus on the domestic environment. And so I just wanted to ask you what the sense is within, you know, this large and very complex partnership of the absence of U.S. participation so far, and what prospects might be, you know, looking ahead, were the United States to join at a later point?
Well, so, Catherine, it's a great question. And you know, you can't escape the good fact, that the U.S. is the single most influential economic power in the world and is typically one of the largest or loudest voices, if I can put it that way, around any global health debate. And you could look back over many previous global health issues and situations, and you would see the US very much there. Now, for completely understandable reasons, I think lots of countries have focused very urgently on their domestic situation. And obviously, we've seen a very challenging pandemic play out in the US. It's something which has to be taken extremely seriously and aggressively to gain control and develop the technologies to bring it to an end. I think as we look forward, I actually think we have the potential for the planets to align in a very healthy way, because You know, what's happened realistically is that Warp Speed and all of the other initiatives of the US have led to the stimulation of some really breakthrough technologies, and they've accelerated things remarkably. That's happened in other countries as well. The US is commissioning significant volumes. And if you go back, you know, if we went back 7-8 months, Catherine, and we talked to economists, then the economists would say the biggest challenge is how do you crowd people in to build capacity? So it's one thing to find a vaccine. It's another thing to make 5 billion doses. Now, what you're seeing is that COVAX, the Americans, the British, the Japanese, the Canadians, the Australians, who I would characterize as all very forward-leaning in terms of their contracting strategy, what they've done is they've sent unmistakable procurement signal to the global manufacturing network of vaccines to stimulate the building of factories and production lines, not just to deliver 50 million doses, but to deliver billions and billions of doses of hopefully successful vaccines over the next 2 or 3 years. Now, I think what will be crucial is as we move into 2021, and I would say by the middle of 2021, it would be really ideal if globally we were essentially managing that portfolio of volume so that the people and the populations who need the vaccine most urgently get it before we necessarily vaccinate people who are not quite in such serious need. Now, that same debate is going to play out within a country. It ought to really play out globally as well. And I think that as countries begin to get themselves into a position where they are able to vaccinate, for example, their frontline healthcare workers, for example, the most vulnerable who've been shielding for the last 6 or 12 months, they will, I think, start to move to a position of thinking about how the doses that they've helped to stimulate the creation of might be utilized on a global basis. Because at that level, you have to start to think about not just your domestic situation, but actually, what's happening in the countries that you trade with? What's happening in the countries where your people want to travel to or from? And if those countries aren't recovering, at least in a little bit, the same speed that you are, you could find yourself in a situation where, yes, you've secured victory in your country, but actually, from an economic recovery point of view, there is still significant drag because all of your trading partners are far behind. And I think we've seen many countries see that. So I'll pick an example, the UK. The UK is really on a par with the US in terms of the aggressiveness with which it really directly invested in research and development for vaccine technology. But it's also been, and it has, I think, 6 vaccines under its own direct contractual arrangement, very similar to Warp Speed here in America. But at the same time, they've put significant energy into COVAX because I think they see the value of making sure that the countries who are really purely dependent on COVAX are helped to come out of this pandemic at least in a similar time frame to themselves. And I think as we get into 2021, this goes from being a theoretical conversation to being a real opportunity. And I hope at that point we'll see some significant alignment as we move on from can we find these vaccines to how best do we use them.
Can I come back to the question that Catherine raised around the U.S. role? What we've seen this year and the last year of this Trump administration is a radical reversal of past patterns, right, in which the U.S. would have been playing a lead element in forging a coalition in response to some dangerous development in terms of an outbreak and the like, instead going their own route in terms of Operation Warp Speed, which has drawn a lot of positive comments around what has resulted. And I do believe when we've seen the Pfizer, Moderna, and now the AstraZeneca vaccines come forward with 90% or above efficacy, it's just an amazing outcome, really, when you think about that. Expectations have been far lower for this. So we're at an ebullient moment in a way. And now we're looking at the Biden administration coming into office January 20th. President-elect Biden is committed to restoring relationship with the WHO and forging some kind of relationship with COVAX and with ACT Accelerator. Tell us what, I mean, we're likely to have large surplus volumes, as you pointed out, along with some of the others, the EC, the UK, and others. What are the single most important things, in your view, that the US should bring to the table in order to sort of join the party and move this process forward in a very constructive, non-redundant way. And what will be most welcome? I mean, this thing is moved along without U.S. participation, but with leaving the door wide open, I believe, for the U.S. if it chose to do this. And we've never stopped sending, the U.S. has never stopped sending observers to the meetings and things of that kind. And there's a lot of technical collaboration. And many of the same developers of these vaccines are the ones that are partnering with us and partnering. So there's a lot of crossover here.
Well, so first of all, you're absolutely right. The door, as you put it, is absolutely wide open. I don't say that in the context of any individual organization or institution. I think, generally speaking, people want to see and welcome US around the table. You know, in whatever situation you find yourself, it's always a good thing. I think as we go through into 2021, the places where I think it will have the single biggest impact are really in twofold. One is the US represents the most extraordinarily deep pool of expertise and knowledge. And it has an almost bottomless capacity to unravel technical challenges, as we've seen in the last 8 months. And I think bringing that ingenuity and that technical set of capabilities really fully to the fore would be important. And then the second, as we've already touched on, Steve, is I do think now that we see the likelihood that more than one vaccine, I mean, thank goodness one vaccine looks like it's going to work, but now looks like many vaccines will work, then I think there is every possibility that the lead countries, which did exactly the right things to stimulate multiple parallel vaccine developments, will find themselves with excess doses. Now, within the COVAX coalition, we specifically designed what we call an exchange mechanism, which is designed to allow countries who find themselves in that situation to essentially make sure that their investment isn't wasted. I mean, I think probably the biggest sin if we got to the end of 2021 and there were good vaccine doses going out of date in a warehouse because we weren't smart enough to get them deployed. So we want to avoid that at all costs. We want to avoid the financial losses that that country who took the smart decision to invest would incur if that those doses were never used, and then find a way to get them deployed to the next best place in the world to make the next biggest impact on the pandemic. And that COVAX mechanism is there. So, you know, if I had one wish for 2021, I'd love to see the US involved in that conversation. Absolutely.
So as we anticipate the rollout of one or more of these new vaccines, at the same time, we see in the United States and to a certain extent elsewhere, maybe not an unwillingness, but an uncertainty about, you know, on the part of the population as to whether they will actually take that vaccine, a lack of confidence. You know, back in March, WHO declared an infodemic, you know, was kind of accompanying the pandemic with respect to misinformation. Is the ACT Accelerator and all the different partners that are part of it, is this question of vaccine confidence an issue that comes up? And how is the organization or the alliance really thinking about that issue going forward?
Well, so it's a great question, Catherine. And it is obviously something we think about quite a bit. First thing I would say is it's very variable around the world. So it's not a uniformly global phenomena. And it's a little hard to know just how deep it really is versus how much it's talked about, you know, and of course you don't know until you get into it. But, you know, if I think about annual flu vaccination, where you might argue that on average, the population are probably, rightly or wrongly, a bit less concerned about flu, and the flu vaccines are a bit less effective than we've seen reported from the lead COVID vaccines. And yet, tens and tens of millions of people, well, hundreds of millions around the world, but tens of millions of people in America get vaccinated every year against flu. So I think there's a kind of what's talked about and reported versus the reality. And I don't know the answer to that, but I don't know whether it's quite as bad as perhaps people might allude to. But it's something. Completely agree. I think what's key to that is, you know, I go back to something I talked about in 2016. It's all about transparency. It's all about transparency, and it's all about making sure that the independent regulators, FDA, European EMEA, the European Medical Agency, and the UK MHRA, and other what are called stringent regulators are given the time and given the data fully transparently to make a really robust assessment of these vaccines, not just the efficacy, but the safety. And, you know, if that takes a week or two longer than people might hope, then we should let them take a week or two longer, because making sure that those regulators are satisfied that they have had the information they need and have had the chance to really review it properly and to make the right decision. And I think we're in good shape here, because all of the manufacturers have been, if you will, parallel processing with the regulators, making sure that information is shared as they go. So it shouldn't take as long as it normally does. I'm sure it won't. But if it needs to take a bit longer than we might dream of, we should give them that time. So transparency, stringent regulation, and then really reassure people, and this is where the US is second to none, reassure people that countries like the US have really great post-marketing surveillance. So in the worst case, if something isn't quite right, it will be picked up very quickly and people will be able to see that. It won't be something that's missed. And so all the way through development, then all the way through the review, and then all the way through the initial rollouts of these new technologies, all eyes will be on to look out for unexpected events. And you saw that in some of the clinical trials, where a couple of the trials were paused while the regulator looked all over it, and then they carried on when they were satisfied. I'm, you know, having spent more than 30 years in the biopharmaceutical industry, I think we can be super proud of the rigor of the scientists who staff organizations like FDA, MHRA in Britain, EMEA in Europe, and others. They are people we can rely on.
May I raise another related issue, which is China? We're witnessing a new form of vaccine diplomacy from China, and we're also seeing a new form of multilateralism, right? We've got China making a pledge to upwards of $2 billion support common global goods, coming and joining COVAX. Wanted to ask you, what does that mean? What will that mean, do you believe? Certainly, if the U.S. comes in, that then you look at a formula here under the umbrella of ACT Accelerator of beginning to forge a new form of civil collaboration between the United States and China, which is something we need to find a pathway for that. But we're also seeing China out cutting corners in some ways in its own vetting of its vaccines, beginning to introduce them, beginning to engage in vaccination campaigns before phase three trials have been completed, and also a sort of aggressive marketing to countries around the world, Indonesia, UAE, Brazil, elsewhere. Tell us a bit, how do you look upon China's entry into COVAX? What role do you see it playing? And what do we make of that as against this form of diplomacy that we're seeing?
I welcome China, any country that is willing to engage in this kind of coalition. And China brings with it a whole series of things. First of all, its own vaccine development programs, which are at various stages of development. But of course, it also brings with it its capacity to encourage others to work in a multilateral way. And it brings with it the capacity to finance. So it's certainly made clear it wants to join COVAX. It's made clear that it wants to option on a number of doses for its own use within China. I think that's very positive. I think that the more we can get any country, but particularly countries with the scientific and financial capacities of a China or the US or the European Union, the more we can get those groups together and start to work through what is the right health response strategy for these sorts of pandemics, I think it's entirely positive. And, you know, one of my great hopes from all of this, Steve, Catherine, is that actually this isn't just a response to COVID, that in the end, what this does is lays the railway track for future collaborations in advance of future health threats, whenever and whatever they might be. You know, COVAX, ACT-A, Warp Speed, all of these initiatives, they're working and they are really beginning to build an armory. But they've all been built after the war was declared. After the pandemic hit us, then we started to build these capabilities. And they're working, but my goodness, it's been stressful. It's been touch and go, and it's required enormous amounts of new ways of working. What's crucial is we don't lose all of that. It's crucial now that we capture all of that hard work, that ingenuity, those new ways of working. We learn from it, and we utilize these ways of working, this extraordinary global coalition, to make sure that we now sustain in peacetime, after this pandemic's brought to an end, these sorts of capabilities, so our response time the next time is much faster. You know, IMF are estimating that this pandemic is going to cost something like $25 trillion of destroyed economic value before the end of 2025. Imagine if we had been able to accelerate our response by 3 months or 6 months, what that really was worth. I mean, it makes the 20 or 30 billion that we talked about earlier in this conversation for ACT A, you know, look remarkably small. And it is compared to the impact of this pandemic. And so for me, encouraging us all to reach across, hold each other's hands, and actually work together in this approach, this is something we shouldn't lose from COVID.
Can I ask you about what happens next? I mean, December 1st, you're stepping down as the co-lead for the ACT Accelerator. There's a newly formed Facilitation Council. It's chaired by Norwegian Prime Minister Solberg and South African President Ramaphosa, and has an array of other leaders. What happens next? How is this carried forward into 2021? The funding crunch is going to persist. So the plan, there's going to continue to be questions. Where's the funding coming from? Where's the funding? We're still at the very beginning of getting what's required here after a very promising start. So tell us what lies ahead and how's it going to be led?
So great question. The Facilitation Council is essentially a group of sovereign countries, as you rightly say, chaired by Norway and South Africa. Also involves some key agencies, but primarily it's the countries. That is the top governance structure of the ACT A initiative. That group will and already has a clear strategy of engagement as we go into 2021 to connect with the G7, the G20, to ensure that the fantastic signals that were being communicated over the last month or two from Paris Peace Forum, from this weekend's G20, are built on and translated into the kind of commitment and engagement that's required. I'm very confident about that. And underneath that Facilitation Council and that leadership, you've got all of the major health agencies. You've got the World Bank, you've got UNICEF, you've got the Gates Foundation, you've got Wellcome, the Global Fund, all of these agencies, and of course the WHO. Essentially, the momentum is there, that they are doing things every single day to drive this agenda forward. And the whole thing is kind of coordinated by what we call the ACT A Hub, which is in WHO. So WHO hosts a hub of fantastically energetic medics, scientists, folks from all sorts of walks of life who essentially act as the oil in this engine. If you think about ACT A as the engine to restart the world economy after the pandemic, then the hub is really the oil inside that engine. That's going to be there working in support of the Facilitation Council. And I hope during the first part of next year, deeply connected with G7 and G20 to finish the job.
Let's try and close with, first of all, what worries you the most? What are you most worried about? And then I'd like to ask the closing question we ask everyone that comes on, which is what gives you the greatest hope and optimism? Let's start with what keeps you up.
You know, I think that's changed in the last 10 days, Steve. I was worried that we might struggle on the vaccine front. And, despite all of the extraordinary effort, we don't normally find vaccines and get them through development in 8 months. That's a very atypical demand on the system. And so 10 days ago, 15 days ago, I was concerned. I mean, having now seen three sets of data, having seen these efficacy levels as high as they are, I mean, we all need to see all the detail, just like the regulators need to see, but it looks extremely encouraging. So I'm very, that has taken away my biggest point of anxiety. What's left is now logistics. I don't want to minimize that because, you know, sometimes we say, oh, we've got a vaccine and we can make 1 billion doses a year. And people think, oh, great, there'll be 1 billion doses January the 1st. Well, no. 1 billion doses a year means if everything goes great, by December 31, hopefully we'll have made 1 billion doses. So a lot has to happen now. A lot more has to go right. The good news is it's no longer a discovery mission, which is very unpredictable. It's now become an engineering mission, which ought to be more manageable. It's more responsive to investment. It's more predictable. But, you know, I'm not going to pretend there isn't risk there. Of course there's risk there. And so I want to hope that we don't drop the ball in the engineering department now that we've just kicked it out of the park in the discovery department. So that's the bit to keep an eye on for me. And I'm talking there not just about vaccines, but about any of these technologies which have been developed. They've all been developed extremely quickly. And we now need to make sure we don't drop the ball in the final quarter of the game.
Thank you. So tell us what gives you the greatest hope and optimism.
Again, having been in this sector for so many years, and I've long believed that we can indeed have a world which stimulates innovation, and we can look after the people who need our support and help drive access. I think those agendas have both been tested, and they are both performing well under the stress test. So we've talked a lot about the performance of innovation, but here we are. We've agreed an allocation framework of scarce resources, scarce technologies globally. We have found a way to engage 186 countries in an unprecedented health coalition. We found a way to think through indemnity and liability so that private sector manufacturers don't have to carry unfair risks as their technologies are brought to market as quickly as possible. We found a way for pharmaceutical companies to work at not-for-profit prices in prescribed fields for certain technologies without spending years arguing with each other about it. Those are extremely important wins that have come from this. If we can not only capitalize on those wins for the response to the COVID pandemic, but use them as the foundation stones for a new approach, which will put us in much better shape for future crises, then for all of the awful things that have happened in the last 12 months, for all of the tragedy that has happened, maybe we can take something out of this experience, which will put us in a better position going forward.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for taking so much time. I want to thank you, first of all, for your service in this role. You took many months out of your normal duties of being CEO of Optum and chair of the United Health Group. You took a leave to go throw yourself into this, and that's an amazing contribution, and we're very grateful to you for that and grateful to you for spending time with us today. And I hope we can continue to stay in touch as this story unfolds.
Thank you, Steve, Catherine. It's been a great pleasure. And as always, thank you for your interest.